Greetings. You're listening to Exploring Boys Education, a regular IBSC podcast examining current issues affecting boys, teachers at boys, and boys' schools. I'm Tom Batty, Executive Director of IBSC, and as always, it's a pleasure to welcome you to this, our latest offering. In this episode, Bruce Collins, IBSC Director of Membership Engagement, interviews writer and Towson University lecturer Andrew Reiner, author of Better Boys, Better Men, about what genuine resilience looks like for boys today. Andrew shares the mask exercise he developed for his visit to New Zealand boys' schools. In the conversation with Bruce, he reframes behaviours such as gaming, pornography, and online betting not as moral failures, but as self-medication for crisis-level stress, and offers practical framework, the four C's of compassion, curiosity, commiseration, and context for any teacher of boys to carry into their classroom. Before we get to the conversation, a quick word on what's coming your way on IBSC. On the 14th of May, Isaac Rose Berman leads an IBSC online program, Sports Betting and Boys Schools, looking at one of the fastest growing risks facing our students and just what schools can do about it. The IBSC Ideas Lab about the internal lives of boys commences on the 13th of May, and the IBSC Ideas Lab for Librarians in Boys Schools on the 26th of May. From the 1st to the 28th of June, we're running two online classes, Mastering Middle Leadership in Boys' Schools and Single Gender Education, a course for teachers new to boys' schools. And of course, June brings our showcase event, the 2026 IBSC Annual Conference, hosted by St. Stithians College in Johannesburg from the 29th of June to the 2nd of July, exploring the theme Sukuma Uye Pambili, Rise Up, Walk Forward. Visit the IBSC website for more information and also to register for these events. Now, over to Bruce and Andrew Reiner.
Andrew, it's always a pleasure to connect with you. I'm so excited about speaking to you today about some of the new insights and new work you've been doing as you prepare to release another book sometime in the future, and also just to reflect on your contribution to our online classes, particularly one we run at the moment, which is The Resilient Boy, and it connects with some of what we're going to be speaking about today. So welcome to the podcast, Andrew.
It's a pleasure and an honor to be here. It's always great to work with you. To be able to work, within the IBSC community is always a treat. So thank you.
Andrew, you've had insight into boys' schools for a number of years now. You've had the opportunity to connect with a number of boys' schools, to work with educators and leaders in boys' schools. For listeners who are new to your work, maybe you can give us a quick sense before we dive into some of the important questions today of what that work looks like in practice, what drew you to focus specifically on boys and particularly on boys and resilience for your new book.
I spend a lot of time trying to understand who boys and young men are today, what motivates, scares, inspires, confuses, frustrates, and even angers them. And the list also includes what really they kind of dream of for themselves and their future. For my next book, I've been learning about this through interviews with boys and young men, informal and formal focus groups, some panel discussions, and a survey I created, which gauges some boys and young men's mental health, a lot of their deeper struggles, and the things that are really weighing heavily on their minds today. I was drawn to the idea for my present book at the tail end of researching my first book. There were some common threads that I kept hearing from older boys and young men that I was interviewing. And in fact, I kept interviewing some of these guys after my book was finished because I started hearing some of these kind of loose threads, and I wanted to see if there was a through line through all of this. So I kind of kept the interviewing going. So much of what I was hearing, Bruce, really ultimately pointed back to struggles with resiliency. I realized that later. And there was something else I started to realize, which was that we were doing a great job of working with a 2.0 script when it came to empowering and supporting girls to thrive and succeed, which was wonderful, of course. But I realized we were still working from a 1.0 script when it came for boys.
It's just wonderful to know that there are folk like you who are putting deeper thoughts into how we can best support boys. And I know lots of boys' schools are going to benefit from your new insights as they have through Better Boys, Better Men, your first book. And we're looking forward to your insights from the new book. But one of the things that's important to us at IBSC, particularly in our action research program, Andrew, is boys' voices and hearing what boys have to say about their own experience in boys' schools and their learning, hearing what boys are saying about their lives. And I think those insights from the boys themselves can really guide us into a place of understanding them better. I know you've been privileged to travel around the world and to connect with boys and boys' schools. And I wonder, in those school visits and research conversations you've had with boys, it seems to me like in some of those conversations, maybe boys are saying things that they almost never say out loud. What are some of the themes that you're hearing most consistently? And has anything genuinely surprised you as you've had those engagements?
They're struggling with a lot more mental health issues than I think not all of us, but some of us may realize. And a lot of them are going missing and undertreated. A lot of boys and young men feel like complete failures when they struggle to handle their problems on their own. A lot of them lack support systems, what I call emotional safety nets. A lot of them are not practicing really important self-help, help-seeking behaviors with nearly enough consistency, especially apart from sports, i.e. in the classroom and in their private lives. Many of them feel disconnected, as I found in a survey that I created, often from their schools and their school cultures, sometimes from their friends and even from themselves. A lot of them feel that mainstream culture sends messages that boys and men who practice any aspects or forms of traditional masculinity are toxic. And for a lot of them, this is confusing and it's wounding. And a lot of them feel pressure to have thin, muscular bodies. Really, it's the male version of what the Barbie doll used to be for girls. It's this kind of monobod physique. To be honest, Bruce, none of this surprised me because I've been, you know, having these kinds of conversations, you know, one-on-one focus groups, large group discussions. I've been having these conversations for years. They worry me terribly, but they don't surprise me. What does surprise me is that there's still so many adults that continue to cling to these notions that boys shouldn't have the kind of emotional support and support systems that girls have and value. And we're still clinging to these beliefs because we still think that they make boys into strong men. And more research is showing that these kinds of behaviors, these kinds of beliefs ultimately weaken boys and create men who are hard on the exterior, but they lack deep resiliency.
Andrew, I think as teachers of boys, we are always hoping that we would get the most authentic version of a boy and that we would build the kind of relationships in our classes on the sports field, in our boarding houses, in our advisory or tutor groups, that would allow boys to shed the mask that they wear or the personas that they put on. But I was so interested as I read about your time in New Zealand and the exercise you did with boys, the mask exercise. I was so interested to read about the contrast that boys were unearthing in that exercise as they would put words like confident and sporty on the outside of their mask that, you know, that's what they show the world. But on the inside of that mask, you know, words like lonely, scared, confused were coming through. And I wonder, as you've thought about this and as you've written about this, what does that gap tell us about the emotional landscape boys are navigating right now?
Let me just say this first about that mask exercise. And what I found, and I've been using it since then to the same effect, which is that it's the most immediate arresting way for any educators in the room and for the boys themselves to see really just how wide the gap is between the ways that they're taught to show up in public and their deeper struggles, and this other sense of self that often doesn't see light of day. And really that chasm, I think, really tells us something even more important, which is that many boys are deeply struggling, quietly, often against themselves, with these profound levels of chronic stress, anxiety, depression, self-loathing, believe it or not, confusion and disconnect on their own. And they often are doing this because of the ways that we still inculcate them with this idea of independence. And they believe that this is their birthright as ascending men. In effect, these are my problems, these are the struggles, and it's my responsibility to be handling all of these on my own. It got to the point when I would do this mask exercise at some of the schools in New Zealand. It got to the point where I remember I was standing on a stage one time in one school, And I said to them, you know what? At other schools, I've been reading aloud what's on the outside, what's on the inside. I said, I'm not going to even this time read aloud. And I said, and I'd say to them, I'm holding up a group of masks. I said, what do you think are some of the adjectives that you guys wrote on these masks that describe the ways that you show up in public? And it was some of the things that you mentioned before, you know, sporty, confident, going, fun loving, funny, you know, those are the kinds of things. And then I'd turn it around and I'd say, okay, what do you think's on the inside? And to my surprise, many hands went up. And boys said things like scared, confused, lost, anxious. And these were things that they came up with on their own. And that really was shocking to me because they were so self-aware of this double life that they're leading. And what I thought was so important, more for them than for me, was to hear just how common and pervasive these feelings are, this chasm is, because they need to know that they're not alone. Because one of the things I've found over and over in my research is that so many boys and young men think that they are experiencing all their struggles on their own. And because they don't have these kinds of, you know, support systems, these safety nets, they don't get commiseration. And commiseration is so important to really helping us to really understand that we're not alone. Because then when we feel a little bit more understood, we feel more connected.
Another interesting thing that stuck out to me, and I actually love how you frame this, Andrew, because I'm sure many educators in boys' schools, leaders in boys' schools who are listening will resonate with some of the behaviors that boys are displaying that might seem problematic. But your research points to a cluster of behaviors, things like gaming, pornography, substance use. And I love how you frame them not as moral failures, but as self-medication for crisis-level stress. And I think that reframing feels important for me. What are you finding out about the underlying stress boys are carrying?
I think it's a good place to start, Bruce, with the underlying stress. When I created this survey called What's on Our Minds, and you know, I was giving it to older boys in, you know, year 11 and 12, and university freshmen and some sophomores. One of the things of all the different areas of mental health struggles, chronic stress was the most pervasive. At the top of the list was their education, were their grades, was their schooling. Because one of the things that a lot of them would say is that, you know, even if my grades don't show it, I do care about school. That was actually something I saw on the inside of some of the masks, and that floored me, was that I'm misunderstood. I do care about school. And I didn't even need to find out exactly what they meant, because what a lot of boys care a lot more about the things, even when they struggle in them and they're not doing well in them, and they put up this front, you know, this insouciance that, well, you know, whatever, it's the bad grade, so what? You know, they laugh it off. But there's a lot of other stressors in their lives. You know, this won't surprise any of us, but being on social media and engaging with online content is very stressful for boys. The kind of pressure that they feel from being in these spaces is far more stressful to them than a lot of us realize. And I think that even some levels they even realize. And there's also a lot of stress and pressure they feel when those who show up as heterosexual and cisgendered men in our cultures. A lot of them feel a lot of stress about the levels of the toxic masculinity being leveled at a lot of boys and young men. So there absolutely are a lot of stressors for boys and young men that they don't talk about, but they're very real. And when we get back to these coping mechanisms or tools, I've really come to realize, as you said, you know, a lot of us think of them as moral failures. I don't think they're moral failures. I think that we should look at them as behaviors that we don't want to encourage. But I think that if we had a different lens that showed a greater degree of compassion and empathy and context, especially, I think it would do us and boys a world of good. You know, I know that some people might say that things like excessive gaming, consuming porn, alcohol use, you know, use of weed, that it's crazy that I'm saying that anyone would choose such dysfunctional tools for coping. But my response to that is you've got to understand the prefrontal cortex of boys, and a lot of us do. You know, they're nowhere near matured. Boys do not have horizon vision yet. And a lot of them are still working from a place of reactivity. A lot of us think, well, why would you do that? It's not the smartest thing to do. And we as adults know that. But in their unformed, immature prefrontal cortexes, these seem like things that are very viable and that work, because they're looking for tools that are giving them quick, temporary relief. And these are things that raise their dopamine levels too. So, this is what gaming or alcohol and weed can do. I would even add, I think that there's an argument to be made for online betting, which of course we know is becoming more of a problem. But I think that when we look at the depths of stress that so many boys are navigating and experiencing, and we look at the ways that these tools for them work as quick escapes and releases, I think it helps us to understand really that this really is a dysfunctional way of trying to deal with what they can't handle.
Suppose then all the more reason for us in boys' schools to create this kind of opportunities in our classrooms, in our schools, to have really good conversations with boys and to help them understand how to regulate and how to manage and handle that stress. I think, we need to be doing more of that. Andrea, a closely connected issue to that, I would suspect, is this whole idea of boys and body image. What strikes me in your writing is how little we still talk about body image as a boy's issue. What are you finding about boys and their body image, and why do you think it's still fairly underexplored?
I was talking recently with an editor about writing an op-ed, an opinion piece, and it's a publication in the States. It's one of the best known for education, highly well regarded and respected. And she said, what kind of ideas do you have? And one of them I brought up was boys and body image. And she said, yeah, we've done something on that. We did a piece once, and it doesn't really seem like it's really, that big of a deal anymore. And I have to tell you, when she said that, on the other end of the phone, my jaw just completely dropped. For once, I was at a loss for words. It really is underexplored. And I think some of the reasons are because we're still in a mindset that body image is a problem for girls and young women. We're also in the midst of a fitness boom, which is a really good thing. We know about the problem of obesity amongst young people and all the problems that, all the health problems that is leading to. And so we have this notion that staying trim and having muscle is healthy, and research shows both to be the case. But the problem is that it's often being taken by a lot of boys and young men into excess. One of the reasons that is that research shows that girls and women find muscular men far more sexually appealing. And that may sound provocative. I don't mean it that way in the slightest. There's research out there to back that up. And boys and young men know that. Boys see their favorite athletes chiseled far more today than they ever used to be in the past. And they're built like superheroes. And that, of course, is going to send the message that, this is something to aspire to. It's completely normalized now. They see it everywhere. It's the expectation. And so there's a pressure for that in terms of quite literally measuring up. Live in these incredibly fraught times where things are changing fast and deep. And the idea of armoring yourself, literally and figuratively, it's a form of protection, I think, for a lot of guys. It really is this way of giving yourself, a bicep up, so to speak, when it comes to the things that really do matter to them. Maybe it's dating, maybe it's, just helping them in terms of their sport. And in terms of, it absolutely is a feeling of protection for them. But like a lot of body image problems, it's also a form of control. Sometimes for a lot of boys and young men, it's the one thing in their lives, like with an eating disorder, that they have some control over. And I think that is no small thing as well.
You're very direct in terms of highlighting how cultural messaging in schools, in media, in popular culture can inadvertently push boys towards the very spaces we want them away from.
Yeah.
The terms that are being thrown around, the manosphere, incel culture, influencers like Andrew Tate. What's the mechanism there? And what do your conversations with boys tell you about how that pipeline actually works? And maybe in sharing that, we can get some insights into how to have some of these conversations so we don't push boys into those spaces.
When we look at a lot of the documentaries and shows like Netflix's Adolescence that a lot of us, that a lot of us well-meaning adults have been consuming, the conversation around a lot of them has often been very one-sided. It's often been that, understandably, that the manosphere is this big, scary place that a lot of us were not familiar with, and that there's a lot of awful messaging that a lot of boys consume that can have repercussions, really bad repercussions for them and for other people who are innocents as well. That's been the conversation for the most part. There's a lot of fear and a lot of ignorance about the manosphere. There's no question about it that a lot of the content and a lot of the influencers do often share racist and misogynistic messages, anti-Semitic as well. So there absolutely are some very well-founded reasons that we should have concern. That said, what I think a lot of us don't understand are the very viable reasons that a lot of boys and young men find themselves there in the first place. As I said earlier, we really don't look at carefully and really give boys a chance to talk about openly the degree of wounds they feel at the ways that we talk about masculinity in a lot of our cultures. One of the young men that I interviewed for my new book summed it up so well. He said, "I get so tired of feeling when I'm walking around in the world like I've got a target on my back." And that summed up the feeling of so many of the older boys and young men that I interviewed. They are confused. And that was often the follow-up question I would ask. Well, how does it make you feel knowing that there's these conversations about toxic masculinity out there? And a lot of them would often say confused and hurt. And that is a really good place to start, because so much of the messaging that's out there that they have no control over really is that masculinity in traditional forms is toxic. And often, you know, there isn't a teasing out of certain kinds of behaviors. There often is just, if you're behaving in certain ways, including not getting help for mental health, that is toxic. Now, having that mentality that when you don't seek help for mental health problems, that it's toxic, that is incredibly unproductive and damaging, to say the least. Boys and young men pick up on that, and they know that, and they do feel confused and hurt and wounded. And so one of the things that often happens in a lot of these manosphere spaces is that there is an acceptance of who they are that they often are not finding offline in large communities. I was driving in the car with my son one day last spring. He was 13 at the time. And I asked him if he knew about Andrew Tate. He said he thinks he had heard of him. And he pulled up a few TikTok videos of him. We came to a stoplight and he said, you know, he's got some actually pretty good messages that you tell me. And I said, okay, let me see what you're talking about. And they were messages about the importance of not spending too much time sleeping, not spending too much time gaming, and going after, you know, going after your goals and really having, you know, intentional vision and steps that you want to take to go after your goals and not frittering away your time. Another one was about the importance of being accountable. When you screw up, to take responsibility for it. We can all agree these are absolutely skills and traits that we want more boys and young men to develop and to embrace. And so there are messages out there that a lot of influencers use that are positive, that absolutely are generative for young men. So there is that side of it. And of course, there is the flip side. Now, whether or not they're using these positive messages that are very generative, whether or not they're using them to lure boys and young men in, I don't think really we should be splitting hairs on that. It's more about understanding with some compassion and context why boys and young men find themselves there, because they do receive some self-help advice, as well as the kinds of messaging that we don't want boys and young men to be single-handedly exposed to. A lot of the older boys would say, you know, there are things that I will find, you know, I will go in there to learn about business, to learn about how to start accumulating and developing wealth and what that looks like and how to do that. Other boys, you know, would go into other spaces for different reasons. Well, it's about learning how to be more confident. And so I think it's important to say this isn't all like an incel reaction at all. It was from boys who were not in that space, but just felt that they were having a really difficult time. And when they would go into some of these spaces, they could get tips. So there were some positive messages. And of course, there are some negative messaging around that, especially when there's manipulation involved in terms of dealing with girls and young women. We don't want that, obviously. One of the things that older boys and some of the young men I interviewed would say is, I go on there, as any savvy consumer does, I go on there and I get what I need. I get what I want, what I came there for, and what I need. And when they start going off onto this, you know, this hate speak, that's when I cut bait and that's when I'm done. Now, it's not to say that all boys and young men do that, but one of the things we don't realize is that many of them do. Many of them are savvy consumers, and many of them go into these spaces for the information that they want and need, and then they don't pay attention to the rest of it. So I think it's important, Bruce, to understand that it's more complicated than a lot of us realize. And it's also important to understand and realize that a lot of boys and young men go in there and they don't get sucked into the misogyny. Some do, of course, But a lot of them don't buy into that. But they're going to these spaces for things that they're not getting offline in their everyday lives.
And I suppose that makes the way we have these conversations with boys so much more important. It's not just to assume from the get-go that they're there for nefarious reasons, but that there might be reasons that they're heading in that direction. And maybe our schools can become places that provide some of that support that they need to not step into spaces like that.
A lot of times boys feel that they're being censored. Understandably, well-meaning, well-intentioned teachers and administrators shutting them down when they start voicing things, you know, from influencers especially, that understandably, they don't want to spread throughout the community. And that's completely understandable. But I think that when we don't have a really clear understanding of why so many boys and young men go there, in the minds of a lot of these boys and young men, when they're getting censored and shut down, we're basically turning them into the arms of the very men that we don't want them to be raised by. In other more productive spaces, like potentially school, I really do think that that is an antidote to a lot of them going to these places. I really do.
You talk about the four C's: compassion, curiosity, commiseration, and context. And I wonder, as we head to the end of this episode, what would your advice or insights be to help educators of boys apply those four C's when a boy is sitting in front of them and shutting down?
I think that when we've got boys in front of us in the classroom who we can tell are starting to shut down, I think that we absolutely can start to employ some of these C's. One of the things that, you know, we can do, and I do want to preface it, Bruce, by saying, you know, I'm speaking about this in the context of approaching a boy without doing it publicly, right? Approaching him quietly, you know, maybe pulling him away from his desk, or maybe just, you know, speaking to him privately at his desk while other boys are doing work. That right off the bat, I think, is showing a degree of compassion. But of course, leading with curiosity. You know, I can see that something is going on for you. What's going on? That kind of curiosity, leading with questions, is always better than leading with any kind of judgment or recrimination. And then, of course, commiseration. The idea of commiseration really can go a long way with boys in terms of, you know, asking what's the problem and them saying something and just kind of nodding and saying, I can understand that. You know, I probably would feel the same way if I was in your seat right now. Something as simple and as small as that validates something that is really difficult for them to talk about, which is being vulnerable. And we tend to think of vulnerability in a very kind of one-dimensional way. We think of it as, let's be vulnerable, let's share our emotions and our feelings. But there are so many different ways of showing vulnerability, and it's something that boys are very keenly aware of and that they want to avoid at all cost. So, you know, when a boy shares anything with us, that is no small leap. That is a really big step for a lot of them. And so it's that we should handle with care. And so when we can give them that space, it's a real gift for them. In terms of the other one with context, because one of the things that's difficult to do, as we all know who have taught or do teach, is that we don't always have the luxury of showing up perfectly to every student when there's some kind of struggle. It's not realistic, and we shouldn't try to do that. But we should also try to understand that, for instance, if a boy is shutting down, sometimes that can look a little bit differently. Sometimes that can be, as I said earlier, acting out behaviors that are disruptive, that are going to probably drive us up the wall at best. And often they will do that because they are struggling, because they feel stupid, because they're starting to feel disconnected, because they're not getting something and they're getting frustrated. And so if we can just even bring, in a situation like that, some degree of context, okay, maybe he is struggling right now to keep up. And this is his way of, for better or for worse, this is his dysfunctional tool for coping. In a situation like that, I think context would really be helpful. If we can just bring some degree of compassion, you know, more, maybe a little bit more curiosity, maybe a little bit more commiseration, and definitely context when it comes to trying to understand boys, that's going to go a long way, not just for us, but most importantly for them.
It's a great way to frame that. Even though you say you don't apply all these at once, it's helpful to have that framework in our minds, because I think it reminds us of what we can do. Andrew, I'm going to close out this conversation in the same way you closed out one of your articles: boys who are taught to create emotional safety nets flourish as men. And so as we close this conversation, Andrew, what's the single most important thing you want an educator or school leader in a boys' school to walk away from this conversation understanding?
That really is one of the most important things, I think, that we should try to remember. Because at schools, we all talk about the importance of community and feeling a part of the community. what we're really talking about when we build these emotional safety nets is really forms of support that really feel very real and genuine to boys and feel very meaningful. We really need to look at this idea of community less as in a macro sense and more in a micro sense, because from this feeling of connection and having support, so much of what we're talking about right now, Bruce, will be taken care of. I'm not saying all of it, but a lot of it will make a very big difference when boys have these small safety nets and they feel connected. So much of what we're talking about will kind of be, will take care of itself. We need to start looking at it at a more granular level and how we can better engage and support boys so that they do feel that they've got the safety nets they need.
Andrew, I'm just reminded, as you were saying there, of the power of belonging. And I think particularly for boys in this day and age, I think we can often be alarmist. But it's wonderful to hear from you that there are things we can do to support boys, even in a world that's evolving faster than any of us can keep track of.
Absolutely.
So, Andrew, thank you for sharing your insights. Thank you for all your contributions to IBSE over the years. I think this has whet our appetite for your new book. So we look forward to seeing that when it's on the shelves. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Bruce. As always, the pleasure is mine.
Andrew's insights into the 1.0 script for boys challenges us to look past the masks of confidence and athleticism to address the silent struggles boys face. By reframing disruptive behaviors as dysfunctional coping mechanisms rather than moral failures, Andrew provides a vital framework for educators to build the emotional safety nets our students require. His emphasis on the four C's, compassion, curiosity, commiseration, and context, offers a practical roadmap for the fostering of genuine resilience and a sense of belonging that allow boys to flourish. Sincere thanks to Andrew for sharing his insights and his ongoing commitment to understanding the internal lives of boys. Until next time, keep on championing boys' education.